Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Puranamunina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusantatami Bhagavad-gītē bhavad-dveshini.
In verse 12, chapter 10, verse 12. I'll do 12 and 13 because they go together.
Arjuna uvacha. Arjuna uvacha param brahma param dhamma param brahma param dhamma pavitram paramam bhavan pavitram paramam bhavan purusham shashvatam divyam purusham shashvatam divyam adidevam ajam vibhum adidevam ajam vibhum Ahus tvam rishayas sarve devarshir naradas tata asito devalo vyasaha asito devalo vyasaha swayam chaiva pravishime swayam chaiva pravishime.
So in the preceding verses, when Krishna has said, I will destroy, for those of you who come to me, I will destroy all of your ignorance. I will take you to me. Basically, I will take you to me. And now in these two verses, he says, when we do the Sundays, Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram, Paramam Bhavam, Purusham, Shashvatam, Divyam, Adidevam, Ajam, Vibhum. Okay. Not much Sunday there, but in this one. Ahuhu, Tvam, Rishayaha, Sarve, Deva Rishihi. See that Deva Rishir? Deva Rishihi. Naradaha tata asitaha devalaha vyasaha swayam cha eva bravishi me. Okay. Arjuna speaking to Krishna in the third person as Bhavan. No, sometimes we, when I'm ever with Swamiji, I always talk to Swamiji in the third person. It's a sign of respect. I say, does Swamiji want some tea? Or what would Swamiji like to do now? I'm so used to it, talking in the third person, you know, to the teacher. But also, like here, Arjuna is talking, as I see this verse anyway, in the third person to Krishna. He says, Bhavan. Means, it's why in English it's like saying, respected sir, or your honor, something like that. Bhavan, giving so much respect. Bhavan, you are, in English we'd say, Param Brahma. You are Brahman, which is limitless. Sometimes when we say the word Param, Param means something, we'll translate it often as supreme or something like that, but it really means desha kala vastu aparichedaha. What that means, desha means space, kala means time, vastu means anything objectified, anything is a vastu, like this is a vastu, any object in the creation. So desha kala vastu aparicheda, that which is not limited, confined, or limited by space, by time, or by objectification, so that which is limitless, so that which there nothing, that which there is nothing beyond, and which is not limited by anything in any way, that's Param Brahma. So it says, you are Param Brahma. No, you are Brahman, you know, the self which is infinite. That self, you are Brahman, which is the self of Ishvara, the self which is limitless, the self which is infinite. You are Param Dhamma. Here, Dhamma means two things. It means one, an abode, that limitless abode. But Da also means light in the sense of consciousness. You are that limitless abode, that limitless consciousness, that limitless light, that which lights up everything. So you are Brahman, you are that supreme Brahman, that limitless Brahman, which is the limitless abode, which is consciousness, Param Dhamma. And you are Pavitram, the greatest Paramam. Paramam means like Param, the supreme purifier. Because Brahman is in itself the whole, right? Brahman is in itself whole. It is not subject, it's what we say, asanga. It is not subject to anything that is objectified. It's not subject to punya and papa. It's not subject to karma. It's not subject to desire. We say there's not subject to ignorance. There's kind of a bouncing ball that goes like this. Ajnanam, self-ignorance, leads to kama, desire, which leads to karma, action, which leads to punya and papa. Okay? Punya and papa means those things which bring about pleasure and pain. And then, of course, once you say, you go from ajnanam to kama to desire to then to the karmas, what you do to kind of fulfill your desires, and then you go to, you can, it, this is, it's really a, like a web. It, then it can go to, of course, sukha and dukkha, pleasure and pain, based upon whether the desire has been fulfilled by your karmas. It will produce pleasure and pain, and it will also produce punya and papa. So the fulfillment or lack of fulfillment of your desires, your kamas, through your karmas, will bring about pleasure and pain, sukha and dukkha, but also punya and papa, because did you transgress dharma in your pursuit of the fulfillment of your desire? If you transgress dharma in your pursuit, and in whatever way you transgress dharma in your pursuit, for the fulfillment of a desire, that will bring about punya or papa. If it's a transgression, it's papa. If it's not a transgression, it's either neutral or punya. Right? But if you transgress, it's papa. And so, papa, what punya, so if we take these two terms, just for a little aside here, sukha and dukkha, pleasure, pain, and then punya, papa. The sukha dukkha is the immediate result of your action in reference to the fulfillment of a desire. It either works or it doesn't. If you fulfill the desire, you get some form of sukha. If you don't fulfill the desire, you get some form of dukkha. It's kind of like the law in the creation. But it's immediate. Pleasure and pain is immediate. Right? It's something that we experience here. But when we bring in punya and papa, there's a subtle result to our actions. And that's what we call punya and papa. Say, I really want something. I really want to fulfill this desire. I need this to be happy. There's your ajnanam right there. There's a self-ignorance right there. I need to have this thing to be happy. My happiness is dependent on that. This situation is getting in my way and stopping me. And I can't allow that to happen. I have to squash it one way or another. Now, I can circumvent these negative situations in a way that is dharmic, or I can circumvent them in a way that is not dharmic, that just goes against the natural order, the golden rule. It goes against the golden rule. That's good enough, actually. In some form, it goes against the golden rule, and then that creates, it will create a subtle, even in me at this moment, a subtle underlying dukkha of the pleasure. an underlying dukkha of the sukha, but it also accrues papa. Whereas if I'm going after a given kama, a given desire, so that I can be happy, same ajnanam there, but my drishti, my vision, my value system is more toward dharma, because I've understood that a sukha that is not accompanied by dharma is really a dukkha. Right? Sukha, pleasure, not accompanied by dharma, is actually painful. The underlying pain outweighs the immediacy of the pleasure. And so my value system goes more toward dharma. And so if it falls within the realm of dharma, fine. If it doesn't, I desist. And so in that way, for a person, in that way, you're accruing punya. That's accruing punya. Because you're living within the laws of dharma. This is, I mean, we can talk for hours and hours on this, but just to kind of get a simple picture of it. But the whole problem, this whole network, starts because, and the seriousness, my own personal, how I take it so seriously, is because I actually believe that my ananda, my well-being, my joy, my happiness is really dependent upon the fulfillment of that desire. That is a huge projection, where I'm actually projecting the very source of the ananda, which is my very being, onto that object. And once I've done that, the bouncing ball starts. So there's the ignorance that allows me to project really the only one and only source of ananda onto the object. And then having projected, of course I have to go after it, because what I need to be is now projected out there. And so then I have the ignorance of myself has brought about a desire, because I think myself is out there. I'm ignorant of myself, so I project it out there. Then so I have a desire to get that back. Then I take action. I became a kartha. Kartha, somebody who needs to do something in order to get it. And then I use dharma or adharmic means to get it, or a blend of both, to get the object. And if I don't get it, I suffer dukkha, sorrow. And if I do get it, I enjoy pleasure. That's the world. That's how it is. And then the world divides up. I'm not enjoying pleasure at this moment because of what you did. And you are to blame for my suffering. Or I'm enjoying this object now, this situation now, because of you. You gave this to me. And you are my friend. This is, it's all a delusion, all of it. But because we're all in this delusion together, you know, it makes complete sense. Because it's an orderly delusion. It's Bhagavan's delusion, you know, within the creation. It all follows laws perfectly, you know. But you have to, in order to be sucked into this tumultuous samsara, you know, you have to have that self-ignorance. The self-ignorance is required. Just like, you know, with the rope snake story that's told so many times. In order to really get involved in the repercussions of that snake, you have to see the snake. If you see the rope, there isn't any snake samsara. It doesn't exist. The snake samsara doesn't exist. You have to see the snake. You have to believe in the snake. That snake is there. And I brushed up against it and it bit me. You have to believe in all of that. And if you believe in it, the whole samsara is there. All of the feelings, all of the reactions, all of the interactions, all of the snake world. You know, it's me and the snake. That's what it is. But when I see the rope, then that isn't there anymore, because I don't respond to a snake, I respond to a rope. That's our situation. That's the difference between having knowledge and having ignorance. Your knowledge assimilates more and more, for your mind, you have recognized that the source of Ananda is you, that there isn't any greater source of Ananda. And it's an Ananda that doesn't even require a reflection in the mind. I mean, the mind can be more or less subtle, reflecting more or less different degrees of Ananda or different degrees of happiness. I'm kind of happy now, I'm feeling kind of good now, I'm really happy now, I'm profoundly happy now, you know. I'm in a state of nirvikalpa samadhi now, I'm in savikalpa samadhi, there's no higher bliss than this. These are all mental states. These mental states come and go. They are nothing. They are nothing compared to just the stable simplicity of your own presence. And the mind doesn't care anymore. It doesn't care about mental states. But because of that, it doesn't have any problems with mental states because they're non-issues. I'm the self of every mental state. And that self, just the ananda or the strength or the beauty of the nature of your being just becomes more and more and more to the forefront, so that what is filling your experience is your being. Right? The experience is all completely here. Whatever you're perceiving is completely here, but it's not away from, it's not separate from the source of the ananda that the mind experiences, you know, either with or without knowledge. With knowledge, the mind itself gets shantavrittis and experiences its own reflections of ananda, so to speak. And for the ajnani also, the one who doesn't have knowledge, the mind also experiences a lot of different situations where there is ananda every time you fulfill a desire. Bigger the desire, the bigger the fulfillment. The more quiet the mind is, the more shantavritti is there, the more ananda. You know? But for jnani, it's really not about the experience of ananda as a mental vritti. It's about recognizing the ananda that is the very self of all vrittis, the very self that is present, the me, that is present to all vrittis, which is not subject to being a vritti. Yourself is not subject to being a vritti. By that I mean vrittis come and go, thoughts come and go, moods come and go, it all comes and goes, it can't help itself, that's its nature. The self doesn't come and go, it's not subject to that. And when that is discovered, that is the greatest purifier, because in fact it's the only thing that is pure. Everything else, everything in the mind, everything within creation is subject to change, and the mind, as long as it's functioning within duality, is subject to sukha and dukkha and punya and papa. It's just impossible. It's like the poor giants trying to walk along a path wearing a mask, a gauze mask over their face, and a little brush to try not to commit the adharma of needlessly killing a little living being. Because like it or not, that little being shouldn't have been killed. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. It's just impossible to be the perfect embodiment of dharma without stepping on someone, without doing something unwittingly, it's an impossible task. So you have to, if there is such a thing as being somebody who is free from adharma, you have to be free from dharma and adharma. You have to be free from that duality. You have to be free from karma. You have to be free from ajnana. It's ignorance, really, that's causing you to have these identifications. And so here, he says, you are the greatest, you know, the pavitra, you are the greatest purifier, because it is the one that discovers you, and in the discovery of you is the discovery of myself. And in the discovery of you is the discovery of myself, really, is Param Brahma. As myself, as Param Dhamma, you know, as myself as being absolutely free of any type of impurity or any type of duality. So you are the Paramam Pavitra. Mm. And you are the Purusha. Swamiji says something interesting about this. The word Purusha can mean a human being, but it really means, for the Purusha is the one who abides or rests in the Puri. Puri is the city. talk about the, like, I think it's the eight-gated city of the human body. So the one who is abiding there in the body, the Atma, is the Purusha. But the Purusha also, and I don't have the etymology of this, but Swamiji says, Purusha also means the one who pervades everything. So if you take, there's a saying that goes, the Purusha Purusha. You know, the Purusha is the Purusha. The Purusha, first meaning, the one who is sitting in this eight-gated city, the Atma, is the Purusha. So the Purusha is the Purusha. The one who abides in this eight-gated city is the Atma, and the body is the Atma, is the one who pervades the entire creation, who is the self of the entire creation. So here, Arjuna says, you are the Purusha, who is Shashvatam, free of time, immortal, free of time, timeless. Who is Divyam? Divyam means something that is, how's the word, extraordinary and impossible, wondrous and extraordinary, not something that belongs to the divine realm, something not available for you to understand here within samsara. It's something which belongs to the divine realm, Divyam. Adidevam, the one who is here as the first deva. You have all of these devatas, all of these devas, but who is the deva of the devas? The one from whom, who is the first? The deva means that conscious being from whom all conscious beings have come, or from whom all of the gods have come, all of the devatas have come, from whom Ishwara has come, the whole order of the creation has come, the Adidevam, who is Ajam, free from birth, no beginning, you know, because the one from whom everything has come, there isn't anything underneath that. If I am the one from whom the whole creation has come, then from what have I come? The consciousness doesn't have anything underneath it. There's no prior condition to consciousness, to being itself. So I'm the bottom line. I'm the one from whom the creation comes, who sustains the creation, and into whom the creation comes. For me, there is no becoming, Ajam, free from birth. And Vibhum, Vibhum means the one who is the self of everything, the being of everything, is all pervasive. So now Arjuna says to Krishna, all of these things you are, he says, in the second verse, Ahuhu Tvam Rishayah Sarve, all of the rishis say, describe you, Tvam. They say about you, all of this, in the first verse. This is what they say about you. And he says, all of the Deva rishis also, such as Narada. Narada's a great rishi. All of the rishis say it, all of the devas that are rishis, the Deva rishis also, like Narada, like Asitaha, like Devala, these are names of rishis, Vyasa. All of these rishis, this is what they say about you, he says. And you know what else? Swayam cha eva bravishi me. You also say this about yourself. The rishis say it, this about you. The Deva rishis, such as Narada and Asita and Devala, Vyasa, all of these also say this about you, what I've just said. And you also. You yourself say this about you. So let's look at this next verse. Sarvametad pratam manye. Sarvametad pratam manye. Yanmam vadasi keshava. Yanmam vadasi keshava. Nahite bhagavan vyaktim. Nahite bhagavan vyaktim. Vidur-deva-nadana-vaha. Says, sarvam etat ritam manye yan mam varasi keshava nahite bhagavan vyaktim vidur-deva-nadana-vaha. He says, sarvam etat ritam manye. I consider all of this to be ritam. Sarvam means all. Etat means this. Ritam means that which is actually true. You can take two words, satyam and ritam. If I put those two words together, and use them, or say, which is not the case here, but if it were, I were to say the word satyam, which it means true, and aritam means true. If I had these two together, I would say satyam would mean you are speaking the truth, what you really believe to be true. You're not lying. You're telling what you believe to be true, even though it may be wrong. But for you it is satyam. You are not lying. You are telling the truth, even though what your understanding could still be wrong, but you are telling the truth. Whereas ritam means what you are saying is true to reality. So it can be stronger. If you put the two words together, then the ritam will be stronger. It's not only that you're saying the truth, that is the truth. So that's why when he uses ritam here, even though he uses it alone, you can take it in that way, that manye means I consider all of this to be ritam, to be true to reality. All of what? Yan mam varasi keshava. Hey keshava, it's a name for Krishna. Hey keshava. That which vadasi, you tell to me, that which you have taught me, that everything that you've been telling me, I consider that to be ritam, to be true to the nature of reality. Then he says, that he says, but nahite Bhagavan, but Bhagavan, he says, your vyakti, what you are, who you are. The word avyakta means that which is unmanifest. Vyakti means that which has come into manifestation. Mm. So you that you are. So when you say vyakti, so he says, te vyakti. It's not just form, it's what you really are. As Ishwara, as Brahman, as the Atma, you as you really are, can say. Hey Bhagavan, he says, the devas, all of the devas, all of the different gods and goddesses and all of the beings, like when you go to, when you leave this loka and go to another loka, you can become a deva or a devata. All of the devas, all of the ones who are living in the higher realms, and all of the Danavas, all of the Rakshasas and the demons also, none of them know. Just as we can be total agnanis, unless you happen to have self-knowledge, just as we don't know, the Rakshasas, the Asuras, the Devas, they also, they're all ignorant. They don't know. Mm. No? None of them know. But these rishis know, the rishis, because the rishis are the ones who have been given this knowledge and who are responsible for the lineage of the Upanishads. So in the earlier verses, Krishna was talking about the rishis as being the ones, you know, from whom this flow of knowledge has come, and the rishis have really been having come out of the mind of Ishwara. So that's why in this first verse here, he says that these rishis all say this about you, and you say this about yourself, you know. I believe you. I know that what you're saying, I accept totally that what you're saying is true to reality. This which, hey Bhagavan, even the gods don't know, let alone the Rakshasas, the demons. This is something even they don't know. But I know that what you're saying is true to reality. And then, so then he says, Swayam mevatmanatmanam. Swayam atmanatmanam veta tvam purushottama veta tvam purushottama bhuta bhavana bhutesha bhuta bhavana bhutesha deva deva jagat pute pate. Deva deva jagat pute. Or is it pate? Pati. No, it can be pate. I was thinking of another better word, but for me, a better word. Jagat pate, deva deva, jagat pate, deva deva, jagat pate. He says, swayam, eva, atmana, atmanam, veta, tvam, purushottama, bhuta bhavana, bhutesha, deva deva jagat pate. It says swayam eva atmana atmanam vetatvam. Hey Purushottama, hey most exalted among beings, Purushottama, he's addressing Krishna, tvam you veta know, tvam you veta know, you know atmanam, Swayam Atmanam. You know yourself. You know who you are. Atmana, by yourself. You yourself know who you are by yourself. Means three, by your own mind. Because for Ishwar, there's no Ajnanam. You yourself know with your own mind exactly who you are without ignorance. You yourself know, he says. You who are Bhuta Bhavana, the very being from the one from whom all beings have been born. The one from whom Bhuta Bhavana, it's now a name for Krishna, Bhuta Bhavana, the one from whom all beings have come. And then once they've come, Bhuta Isha, the one who is the Lord of all the beings. It's from you that all beings have come, and it is you who's the Bhuta Isha, the Lord of all of the beings, the Bhutesha. You are the Deva Deva. You are the God, the Lord of all of the Devas. You are the Lord of Lords, Deva Deva. The Jagatpati. The Jagatpati, Pate is in the vocative. You are the Lord, the protector of the whole universe. So he says, you who are this one, with all of these honorifics, you who are like this, the Purushottama, the most exalted of all beings, the one from whom all beings come, the one who is the Lord of all beings, the one who is the Lord, the God of all, of the Deva of all the Devas, and the one who is really the Pati, the protector, you know, the Lord of the entire creation.
Protector?
The Lord. You could say Pati is like the just Lord. It has a sense of protection. The Lord of the creation. So then, you who are like this, you know yourself. You yourself know yourself clearly. So then he says, Vaktum arhasyashe shena, Vaktum arhasyashe shena, Divyahyatma vibhutayaha, Divyahyatma vibhutayaha, Yabhir vibhutibhir loka, Yabhir vibhutibhir lokan. Imams tvam vyapyatishtasi, Imams tvam vyapyatishtasi. Vaktum arhasi asheshena divyaha hi atma vibhutayaha yabihi vibhutibihi lokan iman Tvam vyapya tishtasi. That being so, that you know yourself, he says, Bhaktum arhasi asheshena. You are able, you are capable of telling me completely without any doubt. Bhaktum means to tell. Arhasi means you are able to tell. Asheshena, without leaving anything out, you can tell me everything. You are Bhagawan. You know the whole thing. You know everything about yourself, about the whole of yourself. You know it all. You can tell me without leaving anything out. And then he says, at the end, bottom, he says, you can tell to me divyaha atmavibhutiyaha, just all of the wonders and glories of your nature. You can tell me all about yourself, all of the wonders, the divyaha, all of those things that nobody can know, really. And all of the glories, all of your wondrous glories that are not known by anybody, can't really be understood by anybody fully as it can be by you. You can tell me the whole thing. He says, all of your vibhutis, by yabihi vibhutibihi, by which vibhutis you remain there, having pervaded all of the worlds, lokan iman, all of these worlds, vyapya, having pervaded all of these worlds, you abide here, you know, you abide here with all of these vibhutis, pervading all of, it's interesting, even talking to Krishna, sitting there, talking to the Krishna, his guru, his friend and his guru. You remain here, having pervaded all of these worlds with all of your vibhutis. And who can tell me better? Who can talk to me better about you? who you are in you. Right? That's what he says. So we'll stop here. He's still going to go on setting this up, and then Krishna will start telling him.
All good.
Yeah. Oh, let's just take a minute. Purnamadav, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamadachate, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Why is Arjuna praising Krishna like this, or what is the purpose in?
I think it's in this section which ends with chapter 12 is really about Ishwara, the nature of Ishwara, and so Bhagavan has given all of this knowledge. The first is the Twampada, the first six verses, six chapters is the Twampada, means it really focuses on the nature of the jiva and coming to recognize the nature of yourself. But the next six focuses on Ishwara, right? And so all up to this time, Krishna has been unfolding this, and Ishwara and Arjuna has been getting it and seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now what he's leading up to is he's saying to Krishna, you're the one who can really, you are all of these things. I understand, I see it, and I have Shraddha. I see that this is Ritam. And now he's going to say, I want to hear from you all about yourself. Right? And so he's leading up for that. And then we're going to have verse after verse where Krishna is saying, you know, I'm this, and I'm this, and I'm this, and I'm this. It's going through that whole, almost the whole rest of the whole rest of the chapter, with a lot of going into the nature of the self also. But then when we get to the next verse, Arjuna is going to say, I want to see it for myself. Can you please give me that? You know, because that's what we're doing in this. That's what this section is about. It's really getting the vision, getting an understanding of Ishvara, to really see all of this as Ishvara. Yeah. And so...
Well, parallels Sri Rudram in a way.
In a way, it does. Yeah, especially as you see, it does. Because Krishna will start saying, I'm this, and I'm this, and I'm this, and I'm this, going through everything, all of the vibhutis. And in the 11th chapter, he also goes through the scary things, you know. I'm not just all of the good things, I'm all of the frightening things also. I'm everything. Well, that's a good point. I hadn't really thought about it, but it's true. You know, the Rudram that we're doing on Saturday is just going through the entire creation, doing like my salutations, Namaha, you know, salutations to you in this form, and to you in this form, and to you in this form. There must be 1,000 different things. And now Krishna is saying, because Arjuna says, you know, you know from the inside. Please describe yourself to me, both in terms of the self, myself as Brahman, the Mahavakya, describing that way, but also in terms of the whole upadi.
And then that helps you change your worldview if you start to see the world that, like that, or is that...
It has to take place, because in the end, the jiva has to surrender or resolve into Ishvara. Because the knowledge is, I am Ishvara, not that I'm the jiva. The knowledge is, I am Ishvara. Mm-hmm. That means, I am this whole. So you have to start recognizing this body, mind, sense organs has to be put back into the creation, you know? As it obviously is, but we don't think of it like that. We don't see that this body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of the natural order of the creation, and that I have a place in this story. And the story is much more powerful. The story is what is the guiding my prarabdha, actually, the bigger story, Ishvara. This is a play, as though this is a play. In fact, in Panchadashi, there's a whole chapter, chapter 10, I think, looking at the whole creation as a play.
Because you always feel separate. You know, I mean, you don't feel like you're part of the story or part of Ishvara. You still feel like a separate entity.
Mm-hmm. And that's why this teaching has chapters like this, to really put the jiva into Ishvara. Because it isn't knowledge. In terms of Vedanta, it isn't knowledge to just say, you know, I am the Atma. I am Satchidananda. I am pure consciousness. You have to recognize that there is nothing but pure consciousness. The Satyam Mitya. That I am all of this. Just like you have to recognizing that the ocean, the whole ocean is nothing but water, and I am that water. I am the whole. The whole, you know, the wave says, I am water. So if they actually just said that, I am water. And the water only goes as far as the wave form. You know?
Yeah.
You know, the truth of me, the wave, is the water that's filling up the wave. But that isn't. It is that I am water, which is the truth of everything. I am the whole. And that's what this is. I am the whole. And so actually, what I'm seeking, I already have. What I'm seeking, I already am. So it becomes, when you really understand, you know, I'm going around seeking, but I'm already what I'm seeking. And so that's why the problem is one of ignorance and nothing else. Because I already am what I'm seeking, then what am I going to do about that? What are you going to do? Where are you going to go? How are you going to reach that? When Swamiji jokes and says, you know, don't ask me to put a head on your shoulders. And because it's already there. You know, you have to ask me to give you something that I can actually give. And so here, it's like joking, you know, he's kidding, but when you ask for liberation, for instance, and the fact is you're already liberated, you know, then how to give that liberation, how to get you there, it's not like there's somewhere to go. You already are that. So then it becomes a matter of knowledge and ignorance.
That's where the whole niti niti idea comes from, right?
Yeah, that's all part of the teaching.
Yeah.
But the first thing to understand, you know, is that that's why we say that the mumukshutvam means that state of desiring to be free will convert, really through the teaching itself, will convert into the desire to know. Say, if you want to be free, then can somebody please unshackle my bonds, or maybe I can run away to some place. How can I get free from this samsara, as though there's some way I can break out of it by doing something or traveling somewhere. So when I say moksha, please liberate me, take me to a place where I'm free. Well, that understanding of liberation has to convert into the desire to know. You know, let me know myself as the one who is liberated. You know, so there's nothing I can do to get there. There's only something I can know. That's why viveka, discrimination, is so important, because you already are what you seek. Mm-hmm. That means something is being missed here. Right? And that what is being missed, not understood, has to be analyzed. That's when we say vichara. It's that analysis into the nature of things to remove the ignorance and to have that recognition of myself, to differentiate myself, the satyam mitya.
Could you say something about where shraddha is coming in and all this? Like, what's the... I'm still kind of looking for the place there.
Shraddha is really important. Shraddha can be defined as belief. As though you have to have a shraddha is belief. But Swamiji uses, I don't know how he's recently doing it, but he used to always say faith pending understanding. Mm-hmm. And so what he means by that is, say if you've been exposed to the Upanishads, for instance. Maybe for some reason you've attended a class, or somebody's told you about them, you know, or you've gone to a lecture, been introduced to a teacher who's teaching an Upanishad, you know, or a text related to the Upanishads. And when you listen to it, you don't know whether or not that Upanishad is able to deliver the goods. You don't know, because you haven't experienced it doing so. Mm-hmm. But there's something inside that says, I will give this a try. This is something I want to study, to see. So it's as though you have faith pending understanding, because how can you really know until you yourself know? And same with the teacher. How can you know that teacher knows until you know? And then once you know, then you can really know that teacher knows, because you know. Mm-hmm. Right? And mm-hmm. So that requires shraddha. There's just something that tells you, that allows your mind to pursue that knowledge, that mm-hmm. gives you a go-ahead prior to your really knowing the end result, because how can you know until you know?
Mm-hmm. There's a trust involved there.
There's a trust. There's a trust that allows you to go ahead mm-hmm. and engage in the study. It's a trust, but there's, you know, something also that kind of inside of you, you just, it's like a, you feel, yes, this is, mm-hmm. you got to go ahead, but yes, I'm going to, I want to do that. So it's like you give the benefit of the doubt, really. Mm-hmm. And it's something that rings true to you. So it's, that's why Swamiji says there's a faith there, you know, that you believe this. This can be so. And so it's a faith-pending understanding.
So that way you can give whatever is being taught a chance.
You give it a chance. Swamiji's told all kinds of stories, funny stories around this, like a person who was blind from birth, some new treatment has been discovered, which, you know, that could give the sight back to that person. And so now the doctor tells him, you know, there's this treatment that's been very successful that can really, I feel, can be really give you your sight back. Are you willing to try this operation? What if he says, no, I don't think so. I don't really believe that there is any such thing. I don't think so. Okay, that's one way he could respond. Or he could say, well, I don't think it'll work, but I'll try it. That's a little bit of shraddha there. I don't think it'll work, but I'll try it, you know. And that Swamiji makes the story more complex. For him, the fellow says, doubtfully, oh, all right, I'll try it. And so he has the operation, you know, and he's bandaged. And the doctor's ready to take the bandages off, but the man says, no. Don't take them off. I don't want to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. Don't take them off. I don't really believe that they will work, that it will work. So anyway, you can make up any type of story around this, you know. But in the end, what has to happen is that he would have to say, believe in that doctor, have shraddha in that person, right? Because otherwise, he would just say, well, maybe there is such a thing, but I don't feel that I would want you to do that operation. Man, this is or whatever, you know, I don't want you to do that. No shraddha in the teacher, you know, or the doctor. And then you have to have shraddha in the method that's being used. And then you take that chance to go ahead. So it's similar here. Like, say the teacher is teaching and you hear something in it that strikes a chord with you, but you have shraddha in that teaching, but not in that particular teacher. You have to find a teacher who you're willing to listen to, both. And so that's why they say the how does it go? The acharya and the upadesha. The acharya and the shraddha has to be toward the acharya, the teacher, and the upadesha, the teaching, teacher and the teaching, because the two come together. And it is very possible to have shraddha in like that tradition, especially if you're an Indian and you've been raised in that, to have shraddha in that tradition but not shraddha in the teacher. So the two have to come together because it's a pramana that's taking place through the handling of words, you know. So that's an important part of it, important issue. And that's why they have, you know, they have all of these, like the Guru Stotram that we're learning, that love and praise for the teacher. It's a very, very strong tradition, that Guru Sisha, because the teacher, the Guru, is worshipped as being more dear to me than my eyes, because this knowledge my eyes can't give me. And so, and that tradition is very, very protected in India. Kind of like in this country, you know, the therapeutic relationship is protected. There's a certain protocol, for instance, in the therapeutic relationship. It's not exactly the same, but I just want you to see, we also have our protocols. Like in the therapeutic tradition, you can't wear you don't socialize with your clients. You don't see them outside of the therapy container. There's all of these things that are done in order to protect the therapy, because these things can all come in as contaminants. Even here in the teacher-student relationship, even say at CIS or at school, to whatever degree it's followed or not followed still, that dual relationship is, you know, you try to protect that so that the student can actually study and not be involved with you in inappropriate way, in ways which will stop and can cloud and mess up.
You lose the focus.
The focus, where you're opening up a can of worms for all kinds of emotional problems. And
but also the shraddha, you know, you can mm-hmm. undermine the shraddha.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these things are protected. In India, that guru-sisha relationship is very protected within the tradition, so that this knowledge can come through unencumbered. And you know, in every class we do the Sahana Bhavatu, what that says, you know, Sahana, may Bhagavan protect us, the teacher and the student. May he nourish the teacher and the student. You know, may he fill us with tejas. May our minds be clear and alert and capable of gaining knowledge. And may there be no enmity between us. That's a prayer. You say it, you know, whenever before, it's sort of commonly said before any class, because if there's enmity or kind of bad feelings, you know, between the teacher and the student, then how is your mind, can it be available? Because it's swirling around with all of this, you know, anger or whatever it happens to be. And so the prayer is, okay, time out. Now we're having this class. Can our hearts be totally open in this class so that this knowledge is not, you know, doesn't hit those obstructions of negative feelings, because that's what they act as a barrier to that knowledge. So, and there's also other, what they call shantipattas, that are said, they'll say, may all of my sense organs be working, may my body be healthy, may I have enough money and enough cattle and enough, as they go through, you know. In other words, my samsara that I find myself in, may it be going well, you know, so that it's not creating any obstruction for me to be able to listen to gain this knowledge, you know. That there be no obstructions on any level, whether it be physical, health, financial, home, all of these things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's the shraddha, is that openness that makes you willing to have the operation. Yeah.
But there seems to be like, especially I think when one engages with devatas, there seems to be like a real depth of how far you can go with that. Like what you were saying, you know, if you just take a devata now and you do that with a devata, then I'm just kind of looking at that in my own life, and then I'm just seeing like, how far can I go with that, you know? It's like to... You can look at the devata and you can say, yeah, I have shraddha for that devata, but that's kind of more mental, really. But how much shraddha do you really have in the devata, that the devata... And I think that translates in what we are doing here in Vedanta, where you really understand, like what you were saying, the jiva kind of returns home to Ishvara. You know, how can I, in my relationship to a devata, come to that place of surrender, that I really know that the devata or Ishvara is really running the show and it's not me anymore.
Well, you know? When you say devata, do you mean Ishvara? Are you using that word?
Well,
Ishvara?
I look at the devatas as representatives of certain aspects of Ishvara.
Well, that's true, but then when you're praying to a devata, like all of the devatas really have certain scopes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so you're praying for their blessing really within samsara.
Right.
Right? So that's kind of a different order. There's nothing wrong with that, but you're evoking them to protect you or to help you
right.
in an area where that's where their strength is, and they can give, it's like Ishwara even in that way, blessing you in that way.
Yeah.
Okay. But so, say you're asking,
uh-huh.
you're praying to Ishwara or you're praying to Ganesha to remove the obstructions for knowledge, for instance, you can do that.
Right.
But then you're also, you're gaining knowledge.
Yeah.
Then if you're gaining knowledge, then the jiva is surrenders to Ishwara to the degree that you gain knowledge. In other words, you already are surrendered to Ishwara. You already are part and parcel of Ishwara. Right? But it's not, you can't really surrender to something that you don't know. Right? You could pretend in a way,
mm-hmm.
like a fake it till you make it type of thing, but it's not a really, the real surrender really takes place through knowledge, because in fact you already are completely surrendered. But the mind doesn't know it.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And so really, the surrender and the knowledge are one and the same thing, you know. You can't have knowledge without having the surrender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the surrender is because of the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's good. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. You done?